My question is, if you could grant up to 3 wishes for our transportation system, what would it or they be? I'm going to wander a little bit. The first one is I wish that if you are a bicyclist, that like bicycling is like 80 or 90 or 100% of your how you get around, that you get a fucking tax credit. Because when you buy a Prius, you get a tax credit. And I think that you're being ever kinder to the environment if you're on a bicycle. Also, obviously, that you would have as many miles of bike lane or bike infrastructure as like new roads, or just that there's a system in place for that. That every other city has as great a system of bus as does Portland, because I am in love with TriMet. And that's about it. This is Anna Olson, and you're listening to Open Roads Broadcasting.
Oh, I gotta make sure my volume's up.
Hello, and welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we simplify the good life. My name is Brock Dittus.
And I'm Aaron Flores, broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
I'm not wearing shoes.
You are not. I just put shoes on.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering bicycling, trains, transit, and simpler living. And today,
leaving on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. I try and make you say stuff every week, yeah. And it just doesn't take. You should start writing these for yourself.
Well, usually we've left them blank.
Usually it's not so corny.
I come up with something. I've come through a dry spell, and thank you for at least writing them.
It's what I do. So, we are here in the studio with Beth Hammond, who some might remember from a year and a half ago. It's been far too long. Hello.
Hi, it's lovely to be back.
Thanks
for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
Our studio was your apartment.
That's right. Yeah, and as we were saying, we traded the noise of the bus for the noise of the train.
Far more romantic background noise.
Oh,
there it is.
Speaking
as
of which,
if on cue.
That's awesome.
Oh, thanks, train.
That's going to get lost in the sound of the theme, though, I think. That was another Amtrak, I think. Anyways, welcome to the show, everybody. We did a bicycle camping trip, except it wasn't a camping trip because it was a cabin trip. So we went outdoors, but then we camped indoors.
Outside.
Yeah. It was all the greatest parts of camping without sleeping on the ground and without being super cold. I think that's one of the only times I've gone camping in the winter and been too warm when I woke up in the middle of the night.
I was going to say, if you're going to do it in the winter, that's a really good way to go.
Yeah, yeah. So Stubbs Stewart State Park on the outskirts of the Portland area over near Vernonia, Oregon, and on the Highway 47. It's a lovely spot, one of my favorite bicycle camping destinations, and now one of my favorite cabin destinations as well.
You have another like cabin destination in mind?
Oh, there are a few. I like Cape Lookout on the coast a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's more
pretty.
Yeah, yeah. But the cool thing about Stubbs Stewart is that there is so much space there. That's one of the reasons it's my favorite camping destination, because you can go in there, you can pretend you're not at a place where people RV camp, because you can't see them, you can't hear them.
Oh, yeah, the hike-in camp.
They call it hike-in, but it's only like a quarter mile.
Right.
That's just to weed out the people that don't, you know, the people that you don't want there.
There are some great campsites like that throughout Oregon that are tent only.
Oh, yeah.
And there are no RV hookups. We go to one every summer in Central Oregon that's right on the Metolius River.
Ooh, the Metolius is nice.
Oh, the Metolius is great. And this one's not very far from the headwaters of the Metolius River.
So remind me where the headwaters are.
The rumor is that they actually start under Black Butte.
Ooh.
So it's in the Sisters Wilderness. It's beautiful. And there are a couple of campsites in that area that are tent only. No RV hookup. You pull in, you pick a spot, and you walk all your stuff to the campsite.
There we go. So no glamping.
Mm-mm.
No generators, no satellite
dishes.
Well, dude,
if you want to glamp, what's the point?
Right, exactly. Get a hotel.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Or go to a place that like provides.
They have those in Sisters. They're rather expensive.
Yeah, the fancy yurts with like queen-size beds and stuff like that. It's ridiculous. Yeah, so anyways, we went to Stubbs Stewart, and the cabin village, as they call it, is at the very top of everything. You got to climb every hill in that park to get there.
Yes, you do.
And you know this because you joined us this morning.
I just did it this morning.
You were stuck at work with responsibilities overnight, so you couldn't join us to actually sleep in the cabin. But you got to show up and smell what it smells like when four people sleep in a cabin.
It wasn't too bad.
That's good.
I decided to bring you guys breakfast as sort of a consolation of not being able to make it.
What a guy.
How sweet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Like, I felt bad because I had to cancel at last minute. And so,
I understand. Yeah. Things come up.
Well, it's not that things came up. Things did come up. But they came up a while back, and I just noticed them.
But everybody's had that thing where, like, you don't realize something is on your calendar until, like, the day before. Yeah. And then you're like, well, all my plans have gone to, they're gone. I'm going to open this real quick.
I didn't realize this until the day. That is a HubWorks IPA right there.
HubWorks IPA. It's fantastic. You've got
I have
cider.
Crispin Original Craft Cider. Quite delicious and crisp. It's true to its name.
Excellent. Is it dry enough for your taste?
Yeah,
is that
good.
A dry cider?
They do make a dry version of this that's even drier.
Okay.
That you might make you feel dehydrated.
Gotcha.
But this is very tasty and not too sweet.
Okay. So you won't leave here all dry tonight.
No.
You'll be properly hydrated.
We'll be putting our bike on the bus.
Excellent.
Home.
Excellent.
Yes. Quite good.
Well done. And what are you drinking tonight? Something that exploded.
I'm double fisting, actually. I opened them both just to see. I have you brought me a Henry Weinhart's Vanilla Cream Soda.
Which promptly bubbled over.
Yeah. Henry Weinhart's is known for this. Their root beer and their cream sodas, especially. If you jostle them too much while they're full.
Oh, they're explosive.
You saw what happened.
Yeah.
They come from a volcanic region.
Apparently so, yes.
Excellent.
And then I've also got a Fentimans ginger beer.
Which is one of the finest ginger beers.
Yeah, so I'm sort of breaking up the sweet with the tart. And
there you go.
Or in the bitter. And
perfect.
Yeah.
Well done.
Little vanilla with a ginger chaser.
But this is like soft drink ADD because you opened them both at once because you couldn't decide, right?
No, I want to see what they taste like together. This is terrible.
You know, I used to mix Orange Crush with all manner of things, but I was a kid.
But
I outgrew that.
I never grew up.
That's what they call the graveyard, right? Where you just like go like down the soda tap and just take a little bit of each.
I haven't heard it.
We called them zombies.
There we go. I sense a theme.
Or so, suicides was another.
So we went cabin camping with Daniel Harkins, who has been with us on Team Sincerity things. And
the muscle.
Yeah, and our friend Kathy, who she's done various bike trips with us, but it's been a while since, but she's been kind of a long-term adventurous bike camping person who is on her way to low car ownership.
Yay.
Nice.
Trying to figure out how to do it. And,
it can be done.
Yeah, totally. And I give her all of our support, all of our good wishes.
And is she trying
to
do this in Portland?
Yeah. It's a good place to try.
It can totally be done in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
There are cities where it's much harder to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So we talked about that and many other things around the campfire. The campfire is the most, that's the thing that I was focused
on. Struck with.
Well, yeah.
Or struck by, maybe.
It was a wet day yesterday and kind of a wet day today. The wood was probably well-seasoned, but had been stored in a shed outdoors, and so, you know, kind of sort of damp. It took us almost 2 hours to get the fire to the point where it was kind of like managing itself and staying lit on its own. But once we got it to that point, it just kept on burning, which I loved. We couldn't put it out, you know. So
nice.
Yes. Nice. It was good. It was a good camping trip.
How long does it take to ride out there?
Depends on which way you go.
So I took the Max from Hillsboro. Well, sorry, I took the Max to Hillsboro. I don't know what time I left Hillsboro, in all honesty. I left from Gateway at about 6:45 and with maybe a 15-minute break at Jim's Thriftway to grab breakfast. What time did I arrive? Like 10:30?
Something like that, yeah. It's like a two-hour ride from the Max station in Hillsboro, or if you leave from Portland like we did, we took a meandering course, but it was probably like 5.5 hours, something like that, with breaks and things included.
That's
lovely. Maybe six with all the breaks. Yeah, so it's a nice day's ride.
Mm-hmm.
I realized, though, this morning, this is the longest trip I've taken. Well, I was going to say this year, which now sounds kind of lame.
It is the longest trip you've taken this year.
Yeah. But
2015.
At least since the summer.
Yeah.
At least since the summer.
Yeah. Well, more to come.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, let's see. There was something else we were going to talk about. It was you were asking about etiquette on the Esplanade.
Yeah. Well, so we rode back. I want to also point out it was really foggy.
It was.
The whole way there. And you didn't really notice it so much on the cabins or in the cabins.
Well, I think we were above it all up there.
Yeah, I think
it's so freaking high.
The sun was out. We were kind of enjoying it. I had my sunglasses on.
Yeah. So the cabins are at elevation and the rest of it is not so much?
Yeah, I think
basically.
The tallest part of the entire place.
Oh, my gosh.
Got back in and, you know, just had frost and dew all over me.
Yeah.
When I got in.
Yeah, we plunged through a couple clouds.
It was cool, though. There's something really, really neat about biking through fog and cloud. And then we got back. Daniel and I broke off from you guys and took the Max from Hillsboro. He had to be at work, and I didn't want to strain myself. And
you didn't strain yourself, right?
Nah.
Good.
No, I feel really good.
Excellent.
We took off from Rose Quarter and took the Esplanade over.
Okay.
He works, you know, down southeast.
Along the riverfront.
Nearish.
Yeah.
We were along the riverfront. But I, being aware that he was running late or running up to being late, we were trucking through the Esplanade.
Okay.
So.
Dangerous place to truck, right?
Already, I know this is bad. I don't normally do this. I take the Esplanade for a relaxing ride. And maybe we should have, like, headed up to Water Avenue or something. But regardless, we're on the Esplanade. We're trucking. You know that area where the Vera Katz statue is?
Yeah.
You know, the fire station.
Yeah. A little bit north of that, just crowds of people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure, because a lot of people had the day off today.
Yeah.
Happy MLK Day,
and
everybody.
I don't begrudge anybody being on the Esplanade, pedestrians, strollers. I mean, that's what it's there for.
Sure. It's a big old sidewalk.
But, yeah, it is. But at what point, like, does my ringing the bell... at what point do other people's awareness have to factor in?
Like how much
etiquette
is on you to ring the bell and how much is on the people to be aware of their surroundings?
Yeah. Mm. Like if somebody's walking across the Esplanade, should they not look both ways?
You would think so.
Well,
should they not?
And yet.
And I'm willing to like take the heat for this.
Okay, I'm going to give you some heat.
Please.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here from the viewpoint of a bicycle rider. I don't ride the Esplanade much anymore.
There's a reason for that,
okay? I'll ride it more in the winter because it's not being used by as many people. But in the summer, I don't ride it unless I have to. And then I think you made the point. It's a big sidewalk.
Ah.
It's a big old sidewalk. And for that reason, I treat it like a sidewalk and I don't go fast.
In which case,
if I have to go fast, there are a dozen other ways for me to get south to north than the Esplanade that will get me there almost as efficiently and allow me to travel at a higher rate of speed. But I'm not going to do it on something that is essentially a big old sidewalk. So that's as much heat as I'm going to lay on.
Okay. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Okay. All
that
right.
said, I almost struck a pedestrian.
Uh-oh.
It was really close. I rang the bell, apparently not loud enough.
Okay. Maybe the person was deaf.
We were like,
air horn?
There you go. We were like inches from each other.
Ah. You got the disc brakes.
I do.
Yeah. Those things worked.
Those should give you away. They squeal, don't they?
Oh, do they?
Sorry. Okay, that's my one little... Who needs disc brakes in the city? Come on, man.
They do. They double as an alert system. Yeah. Just kind of give a little bit of a squeeze in the brakes.
There it is. That's what happened.
Okay.
I'm a little... I'm despite your... I'll take the heat. But okay. I'm still a little annoyed that this guy wasn't aware of his surroundings as he was walking across the Esplanade.
Was he carrying a pink box of voodoo donuts?
No.
Because I feel
allowed to...
No, no. The Esplanade has not been made a toll road yet.
Okay. I'm wondering, at what point does Voodoo Donuts line just stretch onto the Esplanade around the river, like all the way down to Southeast Portland?
Like across the Hawthorne Bridge.
At that point, I move, because that's ridiculous.
That's why they opened the East Side location. It reminds me of, speaking of the Devil's Advocate, there was the, what was it, like the June 6th, 6-6... something 06, I think it was the Horns Across the Hawthorne that
My
radio hero Rick Emerson got a bunch of people to just put up their rock horns.
Oh, okay.
And everybody's standing next to each other across the Hawthorne Bridge. Yeah. The Esplanade is good for many things.
If you suggest it on the radio, it's amazing how many people will do it.
Oh, yeah. People just turn out in droves for something that sounds like fun.
Yeah, okay. No, I'm sorry, that was bad.
People are like sheep. They will go where the other ones go. Following trends.
Well, sometimes we'll bring new breakfast, though.
Ooh.
Speaking of things, speaking of trends, you were going to come in here and talk a little bit about your travels.
Things are, when you had me on your show in August of 2013,
way back in the day,
I was just getting started.
You
on
were
this whole career transition thing, and a lot of my work at that point was still very much based in Portland as a musician and as a teacher. And since then, almost all of my work is out of town.
Yeah,
no kidding.
I do a very limited amount of teaching here in Portland, but it's one-on-one private tutoring for people who need help with Hebrew. Just to, since you haven't recapped, I will. Once upon a time, I was a bicycle mechanic and shop co-owner here in Portland, and I worked in the bike industry for almost 20 years. And in fall of 2012, I walked away from that to pursue a long-held goal of mine to see how far I could go as a Jewish educator and musician and just to see where that would take me.
Yeah.
Because I had a bunch of people nudging me, hey, you should really do this. And I had tried it once, and then I thought, no. And I went back to bikes for like 10 years. And then I thought, but I really want to do this before it feels like it's too late for me to really do this. So in fall of 2012, I walked away from my very long career in the bike industry, and I went into music and education. And because it's Jewish music and education, primarily I'm serving synagogues and Jewish community centers and summer educational programs and camps once in a while. But it's very specific. And what has happened is that I'm no longer working at a synagogue in Portland. I'm now working almost completely out of town. Last summer... In August of 2013, I had just gotten back from a month in Kansas City, in a suburb of Kansas City, where they'd had me out for a month during the summer to do, I was the music specialist and cantorial soloist for a summer education program at this very large synagogue near Kansas City. I went back a couple of times for them while I was working in Portland at the synagogue here. And then what happened is that I was hired to come back to Kansas City in May of 2014. So this past summer, they brought me back.
Yeah. It's your first regular out-of-town gig?
June of 2014 was my fourth trip there in a year.
Okay.
Then while I was there in June, they said, we'd like you to be our musician in residence for all of the Jewish High Holy Days, which is basically, that's bread and butter for a Jewish musician. That's
sure.
Like, yeah. Come do Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and the fall festivals. And they said, and we want you to be with us for 5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So the deal that I had with the synagogue in Kansas was they would provide me with accommodations near the synagogue and a loaner bicycle and trailer.
There you go.
Because I don't have good night vision, it's on my license that I can't drive a car at night. And so I can't rent a car.
And when you're doing music, you're generally you're overlapping into night hours, right?
Oh, I mean, often. Yeah. Well, I mean, not quite as much during the summer, but okay. Once we start getting into the fall, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I was going home after dark. So yeah.
And car rental places with that restriction won't.
No car rental agency will rent to me with a medical restriction on my license.
Really?
Cuz that's yeah. Oh, come on. That's yeah. just yeah. screams liability. Yeah. I get it. I do. You know, and it's fine. I mean, I can drive during daylight hours. I don't feel a need to drive. I sold my car in 1990, and I haven't looked back.
Yeah.
My partner has a car, and we use it to visit her folks who live rather far from us. And if it's daylight hours, I help spell her for part of the trip driving. But other than that, I really just don't drive. So
not your thing.
I just, you know. And so the deal that I have with the synagogue in the suburb of Kansas City is that they would provide me with a loaner bike and a trailer. Well, when I was out there last June, the loaner bike they provided me with was too small, and my knees were screaming. And it was the only bike they could get. And I said, I tell you what, you want me to come back for 5 weeks? And it looks like you guys keep bringing me back for stuff. So now I love this. But we're gonna make like... This lady I know, Monica Huggett, who is an amazing classical musician. She is the director of the Portland Baroque Orchestra.
Hmm.
And she, when she traveled extensively around the world as a Baroque music specialist, she had a bicycle on every continent and sometimes two or three bikes on every continent. And for a long time, one of her bikes lived in Portland in the attic of the bike shop where I worked.
Oh, there we go.
Right? So we would store one of her bikes for her.
Yeah.
And I said, so here, I'm going to put together a bike from parts that fits me. You pay to ship it one way, and we'll have it. I'll have a bike to ride for all of High Holy Days. We'll borrow a trailer. If at the end of my tenure for High Holy Days, you realize she's terrible, we're never going to have her back. We'll give the bike to Revolve KC, which is the Kansas City version of the Community Cycling Center.
Okay.
It's a nonprofit that provides refurbished bikes to people in need.
There we go.
And I said, that'll be fine. You know, I built this bike from nothing. What it cost me is nothing. So, and if you decide that, hey, this is working out and we'll probably ask you to come back at some future date, I'll put hooks in the rabbi's garage and he can store the bike for me till I come back.
Stash it away, yeah.
So by the end of this, by the end of my stay in the fall, the interim music director said, I can store your bike if I can ride it. I said, sure.
You got the green light to come back.
It's never a guarantee.
Oh, okay.
That's the thing with being an itinerant musician is you can work really hard and strive to be excellent and serve their needs. But, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road, their needs might change and they might not need you.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And you just have to – it's been a lesson for me in – I'm very slowly trying to learn how to live with the uncertainty of it all. And that's the life of a freelancer in any field, really.
Sure.
You know. So so now there's a bicycle belonging to me that lives in the Kansas City area. And
congratulations, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Becoming a multi-bicyclist.
But here's the deal. This is where things started to get weird, was because here I was feeling all good about, oh, we're going to reduce my carbon footprint once I'm in the place by not using a car
as much as possible. Beholden to fuel and oil.
Well, okay, but that's a myth, and we'll go there in a minute. That's a myth. That's like saying the bike industry is green. Not, okay? So
super green.
Yeah.
Have you seen the oil they use?
Yeah, have another sip of that IPA, son, and then we'll talk. While I take a sip of Crispin to further delude myself. Okay.
It's how we cope.
You know, whatever it takes. But here's the deal. So as I was preparing to go to Kansas this summer, I was notified that there was a synagogue in the Phoenix area looking for musical help.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends in my network said, Beth, you should apply for this. And I went, it's in Phoenix. I'm not relocating. We live in Portland. Call them. You might be what they need. So I sent them a resume. We interviewed. It was lovely. And they said, so here's the deal. We don't have a cantor this year. A cantor is ordained musical clergy in the Jewish world.
Okay, yeah.
They're ordained clergy, but they function as musicians. They're synagogue musicians who can also officiate and do some of the rabbi-like things. That's putting it in a nutshell. I'm not an ordained cantor, okay? I'm not going to school for 7 years to become an ordained cantor. So there are certain things that I won't ever be able to do as a synagogue musician. I can't officiate at certain things like funerals and baby namings and stuff like that. So, but I can do the music, and that's okay.
If you're going to draw a comparison, would it be the like a bicycle person who knows how to fix almost everything on their bike, but they did not go to UBI or something like that?
That would be not a bad analogy.
They don't have the certification. They're pretty good at doing it.
Yeah. They're pretty good. They might not know how to bleed your shocks.
Okay, perfect.
But in Portland, you know, whatever, right? Yeah.
Right, right.
Okay.
How many synagogues are bleeding shocks?
In Aspen, that might be important. Okay. In Portland, not so much.
There we go. A lot of hydraulic shocks in Aspen.
Yeah. So
in the synagogues? Potentially. But probably not? Okay.
Don't drink so fast.
Right, right.
So anyway, the synagogue in Phoenix said what we'd like to do is we'd like to bring you in. We're going to have a year during which we have a search for another ordained cantor. But we're going to bring in a bunch of different musicians on different weekends, and you're one of the people we'd like to bring in. Mm-hmm. And so there's 7 dates during the academic year where we're going to bring you in for like a 3 or 4 day weekend. And you're just going to do stuff. You're going to work in our religious school, and you'll do service music with us, and you'll work with our rabbis, and it'll be great. And how do you feel about working with preschool? Oh, yeah, great, sure. Okay, so that's what I have been doing. And I, in fact, this a couple of days ago, I just came back from the 4th of 7 visits to this synagogue in Phoenix.
Yeah. Last time we emailed, you were there.
And it's been lovely. It's been really lovely. However, trying to do the environmentally good thing has been harder in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. That's a city known for that. It's really hard to be environmentally conscious when you're in Phoenix.
It's the synagogue's in a residential area. Mm-hmm. And there are actually some functional bike lanes in this neighborhood, which is great.
Yeah.
Lining up a homestay every time was a little more challenging.
Ah.
And the first time I was there, they put me in a hotel that was too far away. Mm. They could not provide me with a loaner bike. So somebody had to come and pick me up and take me back and forth.
How far do you define too far as?
Well, I think the first time the hotel was like 4 or 5 miles away. And if I have to be dressed up and then go sing and be in good voice, it starts to get a little weird.
And Phoenix is warm, right?
Well, that visit was, my first visit was in August, and it was 112.
Yeah, it's pretty warm.
That day. And the next two visits in November and December, they lined up a homestay who actually provided me with a loaner bike, and that was cool.
Beautiful.
My second visit there, the lows were in the 20s, and it was too cold to ride my bike and be able to sing.
Because your voice needs to be warmed.
Right, and it was not going to be, and they couldn't get a trailer for my guitar.
Okay.
Which meant I had to leave my guitar at Temple, which meant it just, sometimes these logistical things that we take for granted in a city as easily traversable on a human scale like Portland, because Portland is a human-scaled city.
Generally.
And Phoenix is not so much Phoenix is not so much of a human-scaled city, unless, I mean, maybe there's an old downtown part of Phoenix, but this is not where the residential areas and the Jewish community are centered.
Or maybe the ancient peoples of Phoenix were enormous.
Well,
covered the earth in strides, 20 feet apace.
No, those were the Philistines.
Okay.
Different, yeah, different. There we go. Different part of the story.
Pardon me.
So
ancient phonations.
The logistical things that we take for granted in Portland are not always so easy to line up all in a row in other cities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I have had to come to terms with, and which I'm still kind of sorting out and kind of wrestling with, because, you know, the Jews are also known by the name Israel. Yisrael. I'm Yisrael, the people of Israel. And Yisrael literally means one who wrestles.
Ah, yes.
So you don't have the answer. You wrestle with the question.
You work it out.
And that's, you work it out. And that is just a big part of being Jewish, is you are constantly in the process of working it out.
Yeah. And a big part of Phoenix, then.
And guess what? The answer is going to change over time for any number of reasons. And so what I have been wrestling with has been the fact that, oh, well, here's this great opportunity for me to start a conversation about the transportation choices that we make by asking for these things as part of my contract in each city that I go to. But the reality is that sometimes it works out really well, and sometimes it's much harder to make that work.
Yeah.
And so what do you do? I mean, like this time I went to Phoenix and a homestay host was not available. They put me in a hotel, a different hotel that was closer to the synagogue, but could not provide me with a loaner bike or a trailer. So then, again, I had to get a ride. Now, they've been really nice about that, and I have been the one who has said, I had hoped this would work out, and they said, look, you know, we know Phoenix a little better than you do, and it's great that you had this idea, but it's not always going to work out, and we're really sorry for that. And I said, look, you know, I appreciate that, you know, my particular transportational parameters add a layer of complexity to your hosting me. And they said, if you were doing this every week, 52 weeks a year, then it would add a layer of complexity. But 7 visits a year is not a big deal.
You can get people to shuttle you around.
We're cool. You know, basically, that was their way of saying, we're down with this. We're cool with this. We live this way all the time. It's a normal thing for us to need a car to go everywhere.
Sure.
Yeah. Portland and Phoenix are not the same.
No.
Yeah.
And in fact, when the rabbi was interviewing me for the position and she said, is there any possibility that you might be interested in relocating? And I said, I don't think so. And she said, because? I said, because I live in Portland. And she stopped. She said, all right, I'm done. Yeah, okay.
It.
She said,
I get it.
We'll have you visit. It's fine.
You like, you know, your donuts? Is that the, like, do people know Voodoo Donuts outside of Portland?
Oh, goodness, yes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, and what's funny is that a fellow who's a member of this congregation also owns a bike shop in Phoenix.
Okay. Huh.
Very nice fellow. And it's a family-oriented bike shop called Sunday Cycles, and they're in Phoenix. And Joe is a lovely fellow. And he gets it. He has relatives in Portland who live in the Portland-Vancouver area. He's visited them. You know, he sees how it's done here, and he goes, look, I get it. I get that you want to do this. He says, it's a little harder to do that in Phoenix, you know, but you know, hey, you know.
More of an uphill climb sort
of thing.
Well,
it's just one of the things, and there's this thing in Jewish communities where you don't air the Jewish community's dirty laundry, and so some people may hear this and go, oh, no, Beth, you're putting out the dirty laundry there.
Ah.
I don't see it that way. I'm a tiny little bit of a class warrior, which has made being Jewish in North America kind of an interesting trip for me.
Okay.
Because for a very long time, Jews in North America were one of the most affluent minority communities here. Mm. And that is changing as our whole understanding of what it means to be affluent or even middle class is evolving with the new economic normals that are happening now.
Yes.
So, by and large, most established Jewish communities with a critical mass population-wise are still fairly affluent. They're still upper middle class. They're able to send their kids to good schools. They're able to provide, you know, extracurriculars for their kids. These are people who actually, like, take vacations every summer and go, like, far away. You know, and this was not my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Jewish, but not part of Jewish community because the price of admission, frankly, was too high for my parents. They couldn't afford synagogue Jews. They couldn't afford Jewish religious education for us.
Huh.
We didn't live in Jewish neighborhoods because the apartments. What apartments? There
it's
weren't
like real
no
estate.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
There. You know, we couldn't afford to live in Jewish neighborhoods when I was growing up. So we didn't. We lived in working class neighborhoods with a little more of a demographic mix with cheaper apartments. And that was what we did.
It's a blue collar experience.
My parents weren't blue collar. My dad worked in hotel food and beverage management when I was growing up. My mother was a secretary part-time. And then when I was in junior high, my dad went back to his first career, which had been music. My parents were nightclub musicians. That was how they met.
Oh, yeah.
So no, we were never a blue collar family. But I certainly acquired a bit of a blue-collar aesthetic and ethic and approach to life, you know. Definitely the whole – I think the whole maker movement right now is a little funny, that people are – you know, that younger generations are rediscovering all these skills that it seems like people have forgotten to. Well, no, I never forgot how to do this. You know, I knew how to start a fire without matches. Right. I built my own tree forts. I learned how to fix a flat when I was 10 on my bike and when I was 15 on my dad's car. I mean, you just no.
Things that should be more second
nature.
I never
forgot this stuff. Right. You know, my sister can take a sheep and turn it into a sweater, and she knows every step.
Impressive. It's artisanal. Process,
right? So, you know, she's amazing. And but the fact is that I know, like, dozens of people who can take a sheep and turn it into a sweater now.
Right.
Because everybody is starting to really be into that. Mm-hmm. But.
So shifting class things.
But in Jewish communities, a lot of people in those communities historically went into what we call the professions, because the whole goal was to be educated, was to make as good a life for yourself as you could so that your children could have a better life. You know, every parent sure. wants better for their kids than they had. And in early to mid-century, 20th century America, the way for Jewish families to do that in America was to get educated and go into the professions, to become a white-collar professional, a businessman, a lawyer, a doctor, a dentist, whatever, and to work your butt off to get there.
Yeah.
And to provide for your family, for your children, and for your elderly parents. And this was, you know, and the whole thing was like, I am busting my butt to do this so that my family can have a better life, so that my children will have an easier time getting educated, mm-hmm. because we'll be able to put them, help them get into better schools. So there was always an underlying ethic of, this is what you do. You make it better for your family, for your community. But it's been a very interesting thing, because I've had the opportunity to meet people that travel as though it's no big deal.
Right. Like, all this hard work involves a lot of driving and a
prior
lot of flying.
Prior to my career change, I could count the number of times I had been on an airplane in my life mm-hmm. on one hand.
One hand.
That's round trips.
Yeah.
So maybe 10 or 11 single flights.
Sure.
You know, I just had not flown that much.
You didn't hop from place to place.
It's just not how I grew up.
Yeah. That's a weird concept if you don't do it a lot, right?
You know, my vacation when I was a kid was going camping with the Girl Scouts, because my parents didn't go on vacations. They worked. Mm-hmm. They worked their butts off.
Yeah.
You know, we couldn't go on those kinds of vacations, really. And, you know, so thanks to the Girl Scouts, I went camping every summer. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Drum and Bugle Corps, I went touring every summer for a couple of years and performed for people. And that was cool. And, yeah, it was work, but it was also kind of a vacation from the rest of my life. So
change of pace.
But so now the weird thing is that I come into this career change that requires me to travel a lot more frequently. But I'm bringing all of the thinking and the reading and
still trying to do it in an ethical manner. Or
there's a book that I read when I started working in the bike industry in 1995, and I read it about that time. In fact, I'm holding in my hand a copy of the copy that somebody gave me to read, and it's called Energy and Equity. And this is not his real name; it's his pen name, but he's known by the name Ivan Illich,
and he is
the Tolstoy character.
Yeah. So I read this book in 1995, and it changed my entire worldview about transportation, about choice, about mindful choice, about why we choose the way we choose when it comes to how we set up our lives. And this book changed my life. It mm-hmm. changed. I mean, everybody reads a book or sees a movie or gets something that kind of turns their worldview on its ear.
One of those touchstones.
And this is one of my touchstones.
Yeah.
And it has remained so. And it's been hard for me to think about some of the lessons that Illich talks about in terms of how transportation, ramping up our speed and our range of transportation choices, is really a direct reflection of the power imbalance in our society and in our world economy. Because past a certain point, you can't get faster without doing it at someone else's expense.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to be somewhat enslaved to the process in order for me to get on an airplane and just go somewhere.
Right.
Like it's nothing. And the fact is that people do it every day like it's nothing and they don't think about it. That's part of, you know, we may be enslaving ourselves without realizing it.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, we're talking more than just the oil aspect of it.
We're talking about the oil. We're talking about the industry. We're talking about the pace of life. Because, let me see if I can find it in here.
And we're talking about those TSA guys who clearly don't want to be there any more than we want them to.
Well,
risk us
you
down.
Know, look, I have no problem with the TSA. God bless the TSA. These people signed up to do a job that nobody else would want.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah. That is an interesting perspective to see that through.
I mean, I am going to read a paragraph from Ivan Illich. And
please
this gets
do.
A little deep, okay?
So buckle up, everybody.
Okay. A people can be just as dangerously overpowered by the wattage of its tools as by the caloric content of its foods. But it's much harder to confess to a national overindulgence in wattage than to an unhealthy diet. The per capita wattage that is critical for social well-being lies within an order of magnitude which is far above the horsepower known to four-fifths of humanity and far below the power commanded by any Volkswagen driver. It eludes the under-consumer and the over-consumer alike. Neither is willing to face the facts. For the primitive, the elimination of slavery and drudgery depends on the introduction of appropriate modern technology. And for the rich, the avoidance of an even more horrible degradation depends on the effective recognition of a threshold in energy consumption, beyond which the technical process begins to dictate social relations. Calories are both biologically and socially healthy, as long as they stay within the narrow range that separates enough from too much. And so, if you want to read that paragraph, it's on page 8 of my paperback copy of Ivan Illich's Energy and Equity. But really what Illich is saying is it's up to each of us to determine to first we have to think about it. Mm-hmm. We have to think about where that place is between enough and too much. Where's the threshold? Where's the line? Once we cross over that line, how do we know we've crossed over it?
Sure.
You know?
And I imagine here in America that line is, at least in our perception, that line is very different than, say, somebody across the world in a more impoverished state.
Somebody who is eating rice morning, noon, and night in New Delhi and living in a room that they share with someone else that's divided by a cloth, and that's their life. That threshold, that line is going to be in a different place on their continuum than it is on my continuum here living in the United States in 2015. For me, one of the things that I have struggled with as I've made this change, I'm grateful for the career change. I'm grateful for the opportunity to use my gifts in a way that is meaningful, that makes a difference, that allows me to be truly of use to others. This career change is fulfilling all of those hopes and aspirations in ways that I really couldn't have foreseen.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the actual work that I get to do, in the moment of doing that work, I very often find myself in a state of either disbelief or gratitude or almost a state of grace or a combination of all three. And I would not go back in time to 2012 for all the money in the world right now, because I really feel like this is the work I'm meant to be doing at this point in my life.
You have a very clear sense that this is where you're supposed to be.
This is where I'm supposed to be. Yeah. And how do I know this is where I'm supposed to be? Because of what it is that is going on in me and around me when I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm. You're making connections with people, and these are meaningful connections.
And I just, it's like the universe is hitting me over the head with the squeaky hammer of fate.
Yeah.
Doink, doink, doink. And saying, this is it. Do this
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
How long do I do this? I don't know. but right now this is what I need to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Right on.
And right now I know that this is how I am of use in the world, and that I'm using these God-given gifts to be of use, to make meaning not only in my life but in others' lives as a teacher and a musician. And thank God that I am in this place and time where I am able to put these skills to work. That said, I recognize that I am also being called to be very mindful about how I got here and how I will go forward from here.
Yeah. And as you do this, if you believe that everything that you do has ethical weight, then you got to think about this. Like, you got to think about some of the minutia of like how you get there and what your options are.
Well, and you put it really well. You have to consider the ethical weight. I have a very dear friend who is a rabbi who is currently living in the Kansas City area, where the Jewish religious choices, as I like to joke, are Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and barbecue. Okay, right. Have you had Kansas City barbecue? I have. It's delicious.
Ah.
But my friend chooses to observe a vegan diet.
Oh, yeah. Mm. That's hard in Kansas City, then.
She's trying to be a vegan in the middle of barbecue heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The belly of the beast, as it were.
Now, she is in the process of seeking her first senior pulpit as a rabbi. She is, her contract as an associate rabbi is coming to an end this year, and she's in the process of looking for what will be her first senior pulpit as a rabbi. I hope she finds a city. I hope she finds a job in a city where it's going to be just a little bit easier for her to be a vegan. Just a little bit.
Right.
That's all. But you know, she's choosing a vegan diet, and she's very clear. She's choosing it for ethical and spiritual reasons. She's saying, I can't eat animals because mm-hmm. I'm one.
Right.
Right? She's really clear on that, and I totally admire and respect that.
And she's sticking to her guns in a place where it's very difficult.
But she's doing it. That's that mindfulness, it's a struggle to be that mindful.
Yeah.
In a place where the options, the alternatives to that are so taken for granted.
For sure.
And so it is with our transportation choices. It is very easy in the United States. In Portland, Oregon, it's very easy for me to get on a bus because when I finish this container of Crispin
this
cider,
delectable cider,
I am going to need to put my bike on the bus rack and take the bus back to where I live because it's not going
driver.
To be a good idea for me to ride under the influence. So TriMet will be my designated driver this evening.
Portland's a good place for that.
Portland's a good place for that. But the synagogue that I serve in Kansas has no public transit to speak of.
Ah,
none.
So cider.
I've never seen a bus stop there.
Uh-huh.
Right? Uh-huh. Yeah. So because they're on the Kansas side of the state line. On the Missouri side of the state line in Kansas City proper, there are buses.
Mm-hmm.
There is light rail of some kind. They don't have any of that on the Kansas side of the state line in this suburb of Kansas City.
Yeah.
There's no buses. There's no public transit. So what we take for granted in Portland is that we can use public transit to get just about anywhere in the city. What they take for granted in this suburb of Kansas City is they can drive a car to get anywhere
just,
they need.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just get in the car.
And that's, you know, when you have to be mindful about your choice, you also have to remember that you're trying to be mindful in a place where the alternatives are taken for granted.
Right.
So right now, I live in a city where there is not a super big Jewish community. And therefore, it will be impossible for me to make my living as a Jewish musician doing it all here. This is Portland, okay?
And yet, reluctant or at least close to relocation.
At this point in my life, it is not going to be appropriate for me and my partner to relocate.
Right on.
So we are here. We live here. Our lives are here. Our community is here. Our family is all here on the West Coast. And that's a big reason why it's not going to be appropriate for us to relocate at this time.
Yeah.
That said, the bigger Jewish communities are all somewhere else. And they're the ones that are in a position to hire me. And that means they fly me in.
Yeah, it means you
fly. And
they
fly me home.
Yeah.
And so every time I get on a plane, I am having to wrestle with my mindfulness.
Which, as you said,
I can't take it for granted.
Yeah.
Because I know too much about how I got there.
Right.
I know too much about how we got there as an economy, as a culture, as a society. And
at this point, if you're ignorant about the effects of air travel, then you're willfully ignorant.
You're sitting under a rock. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I mean, I looked at an article. I looked at an article from the New York Times from January of last year that the European Union had put into place an emissions trading system. It was kind of a lame attempt for European power plants and manufacturers to pay fees if they produced excess carbon emissions.
Right.
Airlines were supposed to be added to that law in 2013, but the airlines filed lawsuits and threatened trade actions, which forced the European Union to backpedal. Meanwhile,
Congress.
Obama and Congress, Congress wrote a law, and Obama signed it into law in fall in that year that forbade the United States from participating in that European Union emissions agreement.
So working directly against it.
Right.
Yeah.
At the time this article was written, they estimated that air travel emissions accounted for about 5 to 7% of global warming.
And at the time that... Well,
but that yeah, was... Going. But that I am, based on what I'm reading, I believe that number is going to continue to rise. Right now it's 5% of global warming, which maybe doesn't seem like so much, but I think that number will continue to rise with the increased democratization of air travel. Greater access, more affordable pricing, more airlines doing it like Southwest, where they don't have first class and everybody flies coach.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you democratize a mode of transportation and you make it more accessible, more people will use it. When you build a 10-lane freeway, more cars will appear on it.
The goldfish grows to the size of its tank.
That's right. Right. And transportation is no different than a goldfish. So, you know, it's – but we can't just – I mean, if we want to make ourselves crazy with mindfulness, and I do this from time to time – we can't
hence the cider.
We can't just talk about air travel. We also have to talk about car travel. We also have to talk about bus travel to a certain extent, at least at this point in our history, when we're not subsidizing public transportation to the level that they are in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is why, you know.
Makes it harder to get a bus somewhere.
Well, it makes it harder to get a bus when your city isn't supporting public transit and bringing that into the infrastructure.
Yeah, and long-distance bus service, like if you're trying to get from city to city as an alternative to air travel.
30 years ago, I could easily take Greyhound across the country.
Right.
It would take me 4.5 days to go from Atlanta to Portland. It was $60 one way.
Not bad. I mean, those
were... that was, even 30 years ago, that was incredibly affordable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can't do that today as easily. And now, if I want to... Now, I the first time I went to Kansas City, I took the bus to save my employer money and have more of that money be in my paycheck. I thought I was doing them a favor. It took me 4 days, 3.5 days to get from Portland to Kansas City.
It's a long
haul. It cost $240.
It's not as good as the
And of course, I do this and they go, for another $150, you could have flown.
Yeah.
It's like, see, and this is where things get weird. But just so you think that, don't think that we are off the hook because we ride our bicycles everywhere. Because this container of Crispin that I am holding in my hand had to get here somehow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it got here on a truck.
Shows up on a truck.
Guys.
Yeah.
It got here on a truck. It didn't come on a train. It didn't come on a boat. It came on a truck.
Right.
And we also have to think about the way how much of what we consume comes to us from how far away and how it gets here.
Right.
Okay.
Somebody turned me on to that when I was in Fort Collins about the idea that drinking beer from somewhere else is kind of weird because you're paying for water from somewhere else, basically. It's like really artfully produced water.
It's bottled water in a different
nonetheless,
form.
Yeah, exactly.
So the last thought I want to leave you with, I'm going to wait because I want to give you guys a chance to kick some of these ideas around and maybe respond and see
right.
what you think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like initially, I've thought a lot about air travel. One of the reasons that I like the train so much is that the train is a bit more efficient energy-wise than a jet plane is. And the jet plane gets you there in a day or less, whereas the train, like if I go to visit my in-laws in Boston, takes me 3 days.
Mm.
It takes a long time. It's not really affordably comparable, like not saving
it's
that much.
It's not so much cheaper in comparison to the time
right.
that you spend.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing I keep coming back to is like I think of my transportation decisions as being ethical decisions, and so I try to do as much as I can to, you know, to use the most efficient mm-hmm. method possible. And so, you know, when we're running the numbers on, like, is it cheaper to fly? Is it cheaper to take the train? This year we flew. I'm not sure if that's the best ethical decision. And the thing I try to say to myself and to Adele as we're trying to plan out how we get from place to place is that, you know, we don't always choose based on, like, what's cheapest. There's another layer to it. You know, is this good for everybody? Is this good for the Earth? You know, how does it fit into the big picture? And so I am not good at making those ethical choices, but I like thinking about them. And I think if you're thinking about them, you know.
It's at least a good first step.
It's a good start, yeah. Because thinking makes you feel guilty when you make the wrong decisions. And then, you know, and then you start making better decisions later on, I guess.
I think the hardest thing for me is to not give up. Because when it comes to long distance travel, I mean, I was in Missoula just over New Year's Eve. And I thought about other ways, like, well, what if I took the train from Kalispell and then from Kalispell, like a bus down, or would it be possible for my brother to even meet me there at the at the train station? Before even bringing that to him, you know, looking at those options and the time that it took, I was just like, ah, screw it, I'm just going to take an airplane. And, you know, that I think had its benefits in that it's more time with my family.
Sure.
But taking that mentality outside of that situation and using it for so many other things in that, like, screw it, I'm just going to save more time if I go get a car for this thing or whatever. Like, trying to stay mindful regardless of whatever compromises we have to make, because we have to make compromises from time to time. There's no way around it.
We have to make compromises with ourselves based on the reality around us that we inhabit along with everyone else. When I left Phoenix on Saturday evening, no one was available to take me to the airport. So the synagogue, the executive director of the synagogue handed me some money and said, here are the phone numbers for two excellent cab companies. I would like you to take a cab. It will be cheaper than a car service. Save the change, keep the receipt, bring it all back to me when you come back in February.
Huh.
Because this is going to be the cheapest and fastest way to get you to the airport since we don't have anyone to take you.
Yeah, right. And cabs are a convention for airports.
And here's the deal. So as I'm sitting here going, sigh, all right, got to take a cab, got to use a car. Cab pulls up. A gentleman gets out. He's skinny. He's got to be in his late 60s. He's looking old. He's looking tired. And here's a job that he can do to earn some money.
Right.
He doesn't have to be able to lift 80 pounds. He doesn't have to work in a warehouse.
It's not industrial work.
He doesn't, you know, this is work that's available to him, mm-hmm. that he can do, that he can earn a living and pay his rent and have a life. And so one of the compromises that I think we have to make with ourselves is we still live in the world. And it's hard to say, I had this great talk, the rabbi in Kansas has become a very, very dear friend of mine, and he was trying to get me to think about moving to Kansas City. It's been really hard for
the lore.
It's been really hard for synagogues in that part of the world to get full-time musicians to move there.
Yeah.
Because Kansas City, the Jewish community doesn't live in Kansas City. The Jewish community lives over the state line in this suburb in Kansas. Kansas City, yeah, you can't walk around downtown Kansas City on a Saturday night without tripping over a musician. But that's 35 miles from where the Jewish community is.
Right, right.
Nobody lives there. Jews don't live in Kansas City. They all live in the suburb on the Kansas side. And he's had a hard time. Other synagogues have had a hard time getting musicians to come and be part of the Jewish community and live there. And he looked at me and he said, I haven't been to Portland, but I've heard enough about it to know that you live in a bubble.
Yeah.
And I said, touche,
yep.
Rabbi,
yep.
You called it. Yep. Yes, I live in a bubble. I said, but I know enough that I live in that bubble to know that it's a bubble and that there's a whole world out there that's not set up the same way.
Right.
And part of the compromise that I make with myself every time that I sell out and buy into the car economy is that I do live in the whole world. I don't just live in Portland.
Right.
I interact with the rest of the world. Our interactions enable people to be gainfully employed. Our interactions enable us to see a wider world. In my case, the compromise I make with myself is I'm doing this for work. This is not a vacation for me. I am not traveling. A Facebook contact posted on his Facebook page pictures from a recent trip to the Galapagos Islands.
Sounds nice.
But he said, here's a picture of a lava
goat. I have difficulty with tourist travel to
And I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you in a second. Yeah. Here's a picture. He posts this. He posts pictures of some really beautiful animals, including one where his wife has taken a picture of him taking a picture of a seal, and he's 5 feet away from the seal with the camera. And tonight he posts a picture of a lava gull, and he says it's one of like several, like 600 left in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, okay, this is tourism travel. The only way you can get this far away from the United States is to get on a plane, because the Galapagos Islands are very, very far away. How much tourism travel is appropriate? What does it mean to be a tourist today? Do we deserve unlimited access to such travel?
That's a big question.
It is. It's a big question.
And there are some here in America that would say yes, because we are the success. We have our ancestors have made it.
It's like manifest destiny for transportation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Exactly. And so we are doing them a disservice by not taking advantage of all of the affluence that has been afforded to us. I don't necessarily agree with that. Actually, I don't agree with that at all. but I'll put that out there as a possible answer to that question. I have trouble with the whole ethos of ecotourism.
Okay.
In that is a result of an affluent society.
Okay.
Of affluenza. The only reason why you're going somewhere to see an endangered animal or to to see these rare occurrences is because we've already fucked up the planet bad enough that these things are rare. I mean, extinction is going to happen. We can kind of take that as a given on the chin, but let's also not take it on the chin and say it's going to happen. What the fuck? Let's take it on the chin, but also go what can we do about this?
Like, can entropy be slowed?
Ooh.
Yeah, or can we at least reduce our contribution to this?
Okay. But how much of this entropy is of our own making?
Yeah.
Maybe it's moot. Maybe it's too late to ask that question. But that's certainly a question that comes up when somebody's trying to be mindful about their choices, about trying to understand the depth of the choices they make.
Right.
My vegan friend in Kansas has to make an ethical choice every time a congregant wants to invite her over for lunch, and or every time she goes to a restaurant, she has to make an ethical choice.
Yeah.
Of, hey, would you mind substituting avocado for that piece of cheese, please? Thank you. You know, because we're all, whether we like it or not, we are all faced with having to make ethical choices every day. It's just that some of us are not paying attention when we're presented with the choice. Mm-hmm. So we don't see it as an ethical quandary or an ethical consideration. We don't even see it as being mindful, because in that moment, maybe we're not so mindful.
Right. And the things are so minute that they might escape our gaze or something.
There was a line in Illich's book.
Oh, yes. A little more Illich.
Just a little bit. Okay. He's talking about the industrialization of travel, mm-hmm. of transportation.
Okay.
And now you got to remember, this book was written 40 years ago. This book was written in 1974. It came out when I was 11 years old. I read it 20 years later when I was 31. And even at and today, these ideas still have traction.
Right.
By now, now people work a substantial part of every day to earn enough money without which they could not even get to work.
Mm-hmm.
So a certain percentage of our daily earnings go directly to paying for the costs of getting to work.
Yeah. It's like the bumper sticker. The I own my car to go to work. I go to work so I can own my car.
And right now, because OPEC is having a hissy fit with the fracking people, gas is cheap.
Super
cheap. It's not going to stay there.
Below $2 a gallon, right? That's crazy, isn't it?
It's nuts.
Haven't seen this for a while.
But the spice must flow.
But it's not real.
The spice must flow.
You talk about being in a bubble. That's a bubble. Right? That's a bubble in the middle of the crude.
Oh, but that's not going to stay that way.
Mm-hmm.
Pendulums don't stand still. They swing.
Right.
This pendulum's going to swing.
It's got some momentum.
Gas is going to be $4 a gallon again at some point.
And we're going to be feeling it on the chin.
Why should we wait until gas is $4 a gallon to begin to think about our transportation choices?
Right.
Better. We're actually positioned better to think about this stuff when gas is $1.95 a gallon.
Mm-hmm. Make the decisions while they're easier decisions to make.
This would be a perfect time for the state legislature to implement an increase in the gas tax.
Hang
even
on.
A minute one.
This,
there you go.
This is our call to action, Senator. You heard it, politicians. All you politicians that are listening to the Sprocket Podcast, go out there. Get that tax. Plan for the future. Get a nest egg. Is what happens. You're a politician. You don't want to be out there in your suit and freaking tie, riding a bike, getting sweaty. Implement the tax. That's it.
All right. Wow, you should have told me. You know I'm a drummer too.
We could have done this live.
Huh? Dang, I mean those rolls are pretty clean, but still, dang. Wow, what else you got in there, man?
Oh, I got it's a box of toys. So no, but seriously, yeah, this is about We all have ethical decisions to make, and even though it seems like the small ones don't make a lot of difference, it's like the small child on the beach throwing starfish back into the sea. That's cheesy.
It made a difference
I mean, it's
to
like,
somebody.
Right, yeah. That starfish got to live another day.
Yeah. And at the risk of getting woo-woo here, because I'm not really a woo-woo kind of person. I was a bike mechanic for 20 years, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
But as long as we're talking about being mindful... Being mindful is something that you can do a little bit every day, like, you know, because you practice at mm-hmm. things to get better at them. Mm-hmm. If you practice at it a little bit each day, then you're not making yourself crazy.
Right.
You're not agonizing over, oh my gosh, this is an ethical quandary, and right. suddenly your brain implodes, right?
Don't let it freak you out.
Don't let it freak you out. It doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
It can be, hey, I'm thinking about this stuff. I'm reading what people have to say about climate change, about the way we use energy, about the way we allocate energy resources, about the way we choose to get around in the world.
Right.
And we can think about it in small ways and make small choices, like my friend who substitutes avocado for cheese, and it's an ethical choice.
In the land of barbecue.
Hey, you know... But it's a small choice, and we have to remember not to beat ourselves up we shouldn't fall into the trap of saying that the small choices don't make a difference.
Everything's fucked. Mm-hmm. We're done.
Right.
No, yeah. We can't go there. I refuse to go there in my thinking.
Yeah.
Everything is not fucked. We are not done. We are still here. Okay. So I can't go there in my thinking. I won't go there in my thinking. I have to believe that even small choices, even small moments of mindfulness, of taking a step back and going, what difference will my doing it this way make, has to make a difference somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It's like traffic is both psychological and physical.
Which is and that's why, yeah, okay, I'm flying to El Paso in April. I just booked a gig there. The rabbi is going to loan me a bike and a trailer for the 5 days that I'm going to be in El Paso. And I'm really excited about that
mm-hmm.
because there's a rabbi who gets it.
Yeah.
And there's an opportunity for me to continue to wrestle with this and make choices where I can
mm-hmm.
that make sense.
Right. Yeah.
That's all I got.
Well, thank you. This has been good stuff. Yeah, this is and for those who are interested in the ethical process, like this conversation has been worth every minute. So thanks for coming in, Beth.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Yeah, can you hang out with us while we read our mail?
I would love to hang out with you.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well, let's do this.
I have to finish my cider anyway.
I think yes. I have to finish the IPA. I get more time than you do because I have to lock the door when I leave.
I finished both my sodas.
Oh, look at you! It's amazing.
You guys finished even.
Well, come on,
your one.
Come
can.
On, let's belch. Let's go. Come on.
I can't on the air.
Let me take you out of this awkward situation.
We got mail. Hey, we got mail.
With another awkward situation.
That's right.
First up, Tim Mooney is dismayed by the possible leverage of fees on the CNO canal.
Oh, yes.
In particular, from $0 to $20 in the time it takes a congressperson to sign a document.
Well, since we've been talking about ethical choices, maybe that $20 will go towards something cool to keep that CNO canal a great place to bicycle tour.
That would be nice.
Who knows? But that is a really sharp increase. First it was free, now it's $20 a night.
Yeah.
This is to ride on the CNO.
This is to camp overnight on the CNO.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It used to be free. Now it's $20 a night. Mm. At least that's the proposed. I think there's still time for people to get. So we got a link on the website. If you want to check out this article, you can, if that affects your life, if you want to go weigh in on the decision, I think there might still be time.
Do it. Next up, Alvaro is rocking our sticker. Oh my God. He's got the old one.
Really old school. This is the one, yeah, we haven't had those stickers, and it still looks so nice. We haven't had that style of sticker in about 2 years or more. So I think we should get in touch. Alvaro.
He also has a Give Me Three sticker underneath that.
Yes, Give Me Three as in 3 feet, because that's legal passing distance there in California.
That needs to be more.
That's not legal in Oregon yet.
No, it's not, is it? I thought it was. I forget where, yeah.
Hello, Salem. Hello.
That's right, paging Salem. answer your phone, Salem.
Okay.
Anyways,
dude, I want you to come to my house with that box of toys, and every time we say something appropriate, you can pull up the right soundtrack
to your life. Yeah. If anybody wants stickers, again, this is a standing offer, but I forget to make it all the time. If you want a sticker, you don't have one, you just get in touch. We'll send one your way. Mail. Actually, you know, since we have this professional address, send us a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Sprocket Podcast, care of IPRC.
There you go.
1001 Southeast Division Street, Portland, Oregon, 97202. And then you'll get your stickers because we can get mail here.
Genius.
Yeah. So anybody that wants one, they're free.
T-shirt?
I've
been on the show twice now.
We don't have t-shirts yet. You want to bring us one? Well, you've made shirts before. Johnny K has one.
That's right.
Okay.
Bring us a t-shirt.
I'm not exactly proud of that.
I'm ready.
Hey,
okay.
Sharpie markers.
Oh.
These are great shirts.
Wow.
I'll Sharpie a big old number 2 on yours.
There we go.
Production number.
Next up, Brandon Rhodes sends us a story about a dog that rides the bus to the park by itself.
Seattle. Yeah.
This has been making its rounds. Yeah. I've heard about this at work. A bunch of people have been talking about this.
Yeah. Eclipse the Black Lab. It started apparently when the lab's owner was finishing a cigarette and the bus had to go. So the dog just hopped on and went off. And this dog apparently knows where to go, where to get off the bus, and does it quite often. So there's a link to the story up on our website.
Intriguing.
So if I wear a collar and wag my tail, can I get on the bus without paying a fare?
It's never worked for me.
No. Okay.
Yeah. If you have some sort of animal costume, maybe you could.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll wear my tiger suit.
It does bring up the question. Like, no one questioned that the driver didn't think like this strange dog just came on by itself.
I am worried about dogs. Dogs have been known to eliminate in public from time to time.
This is also true.
Yeah.
This may be part of the Affordable Care Act's focus on animal therapy. The therapy dog rides the bus and you pet it and you feel better.
So at some point.
And then you don't want to go out and commit crime. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching here.
There will be a therapy llama in the parlor portion of the Max.
Because every time I see a dog board a bus, I want to commit a crime.
A mean therapy animal that spits at me? No, sorry.
I think that therapy llama needs its handler with it.
Next up, Chris Gonzalez says, not the cable.
Yeah, and basically he relayed us a story of, he thought his bike was locked. He thought it was safe. We've been dealing with our own people who are slicing through staple racks here in Portland and stealing bikes.
Yeah, cable or not cable, we're kind of.
Yeah, but Chris had an experience where he thought the cable made his bike safe, and apparently it was snipped and the bike was removed. And it wasn't just, I think he also had a U-lock, but it was pieces of his bike that were missing.
Yeah, it was components.
Just in case anybody got the idea that Chris was dumb and used a cable lock, he's not that guy. He has a U-lock, and then he had a security cable. That's what you and I have used.
Yeah.
But apparently not bomb-proof, particularly where Chris is from. Chico, I believe. He recommends two U-locks, one for each component
wheel.
And then maybe three if you want to lock your saddle down as well.
I mean, I guess with a larger U-lock, I could. I can't get my small U-lock around my back wheel.
Got to get those messenger-sized ones from Kryptonite that fit in your back pocket.
Because thieves have moved on from campy 11-speed chain tools to Sawzalls. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Sawzall, I mean, it's effective. It goes through stuff. Yeah.
How
did nobody notice and stop the guy? Yeah. Look, if I'm 6 feet tall and I have a power saw that can slice through a car.
Also good point.
Are you going to interrupt me?
Hey, what are you up to?
Hey, what are you doing with that thing?
No, I
don't mean to bother you, but you know,
let me extend my hand to say stop.
Is that your car? See, Portland's a very passive aggressive city. I think that could be at least part of
that
the explanation.
Part of our problem.
And you do that, and you are going to be the lead in it, the next grindcore feature at the mission. Okay?
That's right.
I mean,
right.
It's going to get ugly. Nobody's going to stop you. That's ridiculous.
Danger, danger. Well, I think I would probably also say, like, don't mess with somebody. If they got big tools, they're gonna hurt you.
Well, that's why we do have a law enforcement agency. That would be one of their actual jobs.
Right.
You can call them for these things.
And maybe if there was a little more social equity, people wouldn't feel the need to steal bicycles. Maybe. Just saying.
Next up, Logan Smith sends us an article about smart grips.
Yeah,
which you were very impressed by.
I'm interested in them because this is it's a tactile direction facility. Basically, it's a piece of your bike. You put them in your grips, and of course this revolves around having a bicycle with flat handlebars. I think at least that's the model they have displayed on the website.
Yeah,
maybe someday they'll have some for our styles of handlebars as well. For drop bars and such, but it'll
buzz. I
have
pretty long drops, though. I wonder if it would still slide in mine.
It's a good question. Anyway. This is basically providing tactile feedback to give you directions. So you pair it with your smartphone, you get your Google Maps or what have you pulled up, and they say, you know, these are your directions. And then as you ride your bike, when you're supposed to turn, the handlebars buzz on the side in which you're supposed to make the turn. So it's very interesting. It's still a Kickstarter or whatever it is. It's an Indiegogo campaign.
Indiegogo.
So it is not yet funded. If you like
this
idea, yes, you could help them develop it with your cash. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Next, Gerald, I'm writing to thank you for answering my question about normal looking pants that dry quickly.
Oh, yeah.
This was a couple months back on We Got Mail. Based on your recommendation, I purchased a pair of 100% polyester jeans.
Yeah.
I love them. They do a good job of wicking away rain. They never feel soggy and gross the way normal jeans do. And they certainly dry faster than normal jeans.
You're pointing to the ones you're wearing now?
They are normal.
Okay, yeah.
Semi-normal jeans. For light rain, I don't wear rain pants anymore. My
kinda
only
like
problem
this
is
morning.
Finding more polyester jeans. I found my pair on eBay for $20, but that was pure luck. Now I can't find my size on eBay. And yeah, you have the same problem?
I bought like 5 pairs of pants off eBay last year. I still have yet to hem them to my size. But yeah. I like to get my clothes used. He's asking where he could find them, and he's also debating scotch guarding a pair of cotton jeans.
Oh, yes.
You've done some waxing of your own clothing.
I waxed a jacket, and I'm very satisfied with it.
Right. And that's not code for
to
anything.
To the point. Nope, that is what I said.
Yes.
To the point where I was even thinking about waxing a pair of pants, and then he mentioned it. So I think I still have some
what
of that wax
What are you using
left
to
over.
Wax it? Is this the Caradise proofing wax?
No, but that would work, I bet. it's a Portland company called Duck Wax.
Okay.
Otter Wax.
Otter Wax.
So as long as we're talking about local stuff, I know, I mean, look, I buy stuff off of eBay. I've sold stuff on eBay. But eBay... Okay.
Not based in Portland.
Hey, and neither is most of the stuff we're buying. So every once in a while, I'll see something on eBay. I'll go, oh, that looks kind of cool. And then I'll go to Goodwill down the street and say if they have something similar there.
True.
Because then I'm not paying shipping. And I'm not paying somebody to put it in a truck and drive it across 5 states to get to me. Just a point. And look, it's not like I'm all pure and think this way all the time, but every once in a while, you know, I challenge myself to consider it.
Right. Yeah, find it where you can. If you can get it locally, all that much the
absolutely.
Better.
Absolutely.
Oftentimes, I've found that I'm assuming Gerald's writing from Portland. I couldn't quite tell, but I'm guessing that he does. There are a bunch of vintage shops in various parts of town that would carry, like, I'm not sure if you found the Levi's 517s that I wear that are made of poly. But they're the ones I prefer. They're a little out of fashion, so it is hard to find them in stock in places.
They don't even make them anymore, right?
I don't believe so.
Right.
At one point, Hollywood Vintage over there in the Sandy and Hollywood area, they had like stacks, like up to the ceiling of these pants that I love. And then I went in there a couple years later and they didn't have them in stock anymore. There was not a pair to be found in that store. So it's tricky, yeah. But, if you're not particular about style, any outdoor gear retailer would probably have something that's made of poly that wouldn't necessarily absorb. Personal sense of style is kind of hard to account for.
Yeah. Well, personal sense of style and then as social trends come and go.
Right.
I'm finding because I like tight jeans and the trend is it's starting to swing away from tight jeans.
Oh, right. So it's been in a good season, but it's harder to find your tight jeans now.
It's harder to find those used these days.
As Macklemore says, look through the entire thrift store, even the ladies section.
That's where I go first.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Or vice versa. If you happen to be a lady, check out the men's section. They might have something you like.
Like that shirt?
You're popping your collar there. Not popping it, but
All my shirts are men's shirts.
Nice.
Yes.
A good collared shirt, by the way. I think I've said before, but a good collared shirt and a crease in your pants will get you a lot of respect almost anywhere you go.
In Portland, a shirt with a collar that folds over is considered dressing up.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm dressed up here. I dressed up for this.
We appreciate you dressing up for
this. I have a look for radio.
Thank you. lastly, Eric.
Eric Iverson tweets
sure to
us.
Offend at least half of our listener base.
All right. I would say that's our disclaimer here.
That's it.
In response to our 24-hour eating places.
Where do you find food at 3 a.m.?
Southeast Grind also serves delicious 24-hour food. And I also don't like Dave Matthews or his band or any combination thereof.
There you go. I'm interested what Dave Matthews without his band would sound like because that's rare.
He toured a couple times. I can't believe I know this. He toured a couple times with a friend of his, Tim something or another.
Oh, right. The band without Dave Matthews?
There was no band. It was just the two guys, acoustic guitars, and then Dave singing.
Right, right. So if you wanted to hear just the drummer or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I had a boss that would often say that the Dave Matthews Band should be called the Carter Buford Band.
Right, right. May he rest in peace.
He's dead?
I think so.
I thought it was the sax player that was the dead one.
There's been a few now, I think.
Mother of God.
Yeah. And then next you can fill us in on the Grateful Dead stuff that you know.
No.
Okay.
All right. So you guys were talking about 24-hour food. Had either of you moved to Portland yet before Quality Pie closed?
Quality Pie.
I have never heard of Quality Pie.
Okay, you guys don't know for Quality Pie.
It had been closed by the time I got here.
I'm putting a shout out to all the people who've lived in Portland long enough to remember Quality Pie.
Or people who've visited Portland and went to Quality Pie.
That was the place to get coffee and made from scratch apple pie at 3 a.m.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So where was this?
It was in Northwest Portland.
Okay.
And it's no longer there. It's sad.
Yeah. Many things are not.
As a friend of mine likes to say, this is so not Portland 5 years ago.
It's true. to close us out today.
Oh, yeah.
To play us out. What does that even mean? We'll do it live.
play us out. I don't know what that means. It says Sting here.
People who are on the internet 5 years ago remember that. It was funny to them. Anyways, this is Jim. Is it Jim Gooden, right?
Jim Gooden.
Yes. And he's doing some experimental music with his guitar and his son's bicycle.
Yeah.
And I think a pencil. So we played some of this about a month ago or more, he sent us another track that he just worked up.
Very cool.
So we'll go out on this. But let's read some credits, shall we?
Let's do it.
Thank you again, Beth, for coming in. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Oh, thanks for having me.
Before I forget, you have a website.
I do.
And you make music. You're not just a professional cantor. You also have some CDs for sale.
I do.
Albums. Digital downloads. Vinyl.
Beth, Hamon, at CD Baby. You can just Google my name at cdbaby.com, and it's all there.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Excellent. And you emailed me a couple tracks. Could I put one at the end of this?
You could, sure.
All right, excellent. So we'll put a little piece
bonus
of...
bonus track, listeners.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's close this thing out.
All right. Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. I feel the need to go slower now. Send feedback via email. to thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Call or text 2503-847-9774. Twitter to Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for our theme music. Thanks to Herb Bird for our headline sounder that we didn't use. Thanks to Marcus Norman for graphic design. And thanks to our sustaining donors, Logan Smith, Johnny K, Shadowfoot, Katrina Mellengard,
Wayne Norman, Doug Robertson, Ethan Georgie,
Justin Martin, Eric Iverson, Cameron Lee,
Richard Wazensky, Tim Mooney, Orange and Purple,
Glenn Kubish, Matt Kelly, Jim Gooden,
this guy, Eric Weiss, Doug Cohen-Miller, Todd Parker,
Scott McAllister Morgan, Chris Gonzalez, Dan Gebhardt, and Zoe Campagna.
Enjoy.
Brush your teeth.
Yeah. Go to bed. We'll see you soon.
Listening to Open Roads Broadcasting.